The longtime president of a Northern New York university is calling it quits and looking back on the changes he's worked through.
In 2004, when Lisa and I arrived in town, Mark Zuckerberg was living in a dorm at Harvard.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, an exit interview from SUNY Plattsburgh. We'll also look at what makes a good school principal, college students' favorite candy-flavored addiction, and spend an academic minute taking a walk in the woods. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The State University of New York at Plattsburgh is located along the banks of the Saranac River, a few miles from the western shore of Lake Champlain, and about a 30-minute drive from the Canadian border in northern New York. University President Dr. John Etling has announced he is retiring this summer after leading the college for 15 years. During his tenure, the campus undertook its first $16 million capital campaign. But he also faced challenges. In 2015, the student newspaper published a front-page cartoon featuring a black student in cap and gown, drawn with exaggerated, bulging white eyes and mouth that most people considered racist. Then in 2018, a student went on Snapchat and posted about lynching using the N-word. That incident led to student rallies and votes of no confidence against the administration. As Dr. Etling looks back at his time, he talks about the ups and the downs of his tenure with the best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley.
You came here in 2004, I believe.
That's right, Pat.
Why did you want to lead SUNY Plattsburgh in the first place?
Well, I wanted to be a college president. I had lived in Saratoga Springs 1989-91 and was a visiting professor at Union. I love this part of the country. I'd never spent any time in it before. So I said, if something comes along in this part of upstate New York, a presidency, I want it. And lo and behold, Plattsburgh had an opening. And it was an ideal kind of school from my point of view. It's a small residential undergraduate liberal arts with professional schools programs grafted successfully onto that in a gorgeous corner of New York. So I said, great, let's do this. This is what I've been preparing for all my career. So that's it. That's the long-winded answer to your simple question, yeah.
Well, you stayed for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Fundraising is a big part of being a college president. And one of the things you did was lead a $16 million capital campaign. How do you approach fundraising?
I was the face of that, but most of the real good work was done by Ann Hansen and her colleagues in institutional advancement. They would just bring me out to shake hands and receive the check in someone's office, or else to show up with my wife, who's marvelous at this kind of work. So I can't take credit for that.
Well, whether it was the fundraising or dealing with the fiscal ups and downs of the college itself, you came in 2004. That was before the 2008 recession, and you've obviously been here beyond that. What have been the fiscal challenges at the college as you've been here over that decade and a half?
But it's almost, in some ways, I don't know, it's like Joseph interpreting Pharaoh's dream. I mean, there were seven good years and then seven lean years. And the first 7 or 8 years I was here, enrollments were rising, budgets were good. And then the recession came, and then enrollments started to fall. And that's what we've been contending with ever since. About 2010 is when enrollment started a gradual decline. And the reasons for that are pretty simple. They're completely demographic. There are fewer and fewer graduates of North Country high schools, and that's been our traditional catchment area since 1889. We go to New York City, which is the only place in the state where high school graduation numbers are actually stable or growing. So if we're going to keep enrollments up, we have to go farther afield to find students. Everyone's in New York City recruiting. It's a pretty heavy lift to bring a young person from the Bronx or Brooklyn to Plattsburgh. But the reason enrollments are so important is because about 82% of what we spend every year at the college comes from our students. Taxpayers through the legislature, through the appropriations process, account for maybe 18% of what we spend now. So enrollments are critical. The enrollments equal budgets. Fewer students means less money to spend. 85% of what we spend every year is salaries. So fewer students, less money, fewer employees. That's the iron law of enrollments. It's not just New York. It's nationwide.
Well, with that equation, too, is there also a quota from SUNY that says you must have X number of students each year?
No.
You also mentioned going further afield for enrollments. Does that mean you have to compromise the quality of students that you do enroll?
I don't. Well, put it this way. The last couple of years, we've admitted students with lower SAT scores and high school grade point averages than we did 10, 12 years ago. There was one point, 2006, 8 in there, where we were actually admitting only about 46% of the students who applied. We don't have that luxury now. So we're admitting students who do have slightly lower SATs and high school GPAs, but they are still, on paper at least, prepared for college work, but just perhaps not as well prepared as some of the students who are applying. Their older brothers and sisters say, well, except the same family, they're probably equally bright. So, in any event, yeah. And that presents challenges to our faculty as well.
Dr. Ettling, you mentioned in moving further afield, you also are getting more diverse students in, even though diversity is an issue in that the college is still mostly white.
Yeah, although mostly. Two falls ago, 41, 42% of our entering freshman class were students of color. That's a substantial increase since I arrived in 2004.
Last year, it seemed like diversity issues really peaked on the campus. In February, you had the racist Snapchat post. There were protests. I mean, there was even an effort to have some of the senior administration resign, including you. Looking back at that, what do you make of everything that occurred then? Would you have changed the way you handled it?
I'm sure we could have done a better job. Although, Pat, let me say that following up on a complaint to the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Education, they actually did conduct a retrospective investigation of not just the incident, but its aftermath and how the college handled it. They wrote a report. It was a lengthy report. It came out last summer, and they said that we had responded promptly and appropriately. So, yeah, I'm sure there are things we could have done differently, and we could have had some of the things in place then that we have now that would, I think, reduce, although not eliminate, the possibility of this kind of incident happening again or in responding to it more effectively than we did then. But both of the incidents, the Cardinal Points cartoon and the Snapchat post, were students who had no idea what they were doing and the kind of anger that they were going to release. There will be students like that. Part of what we're supposed to be doing is providing them with an education that will allow them to live comfortably in the 21st century as adults. And you know, the second incident, the young woman had grown up in Keene, and she didn't think there was anything wrong with what she did until the reaction hit. The young man who drew the editorial cartoon for Cardinal Points had no idea that it would be seen as racist. He didn't really understand what that meant, I don't think. When we looked into how this came to be, found out that he grew up on Long Island and reached the age of 20 or whatever without ever having heard of affirmative action. So that's a failure on the part of all his teachers and us included, his family, his church, his friends, how do you not know, at least have heard of affirmative action? You can hate it or you can like it, but to be oblivious and to give this person access to thousands and thousands of people through an editorial cartoon, that's, things like that will happen. It will happen, and it happens on all college campuses.
Well, Dr. Atling, as much as it being a learning experience for the students, how much of a learning experience was it for you to go through those?
That's a good question, Pat, and it was. It was a painful learning experience because I think that a major part, if not the major part, of my job is to make the students who come to Plattsburgh feel comfortable and safe on our campus. If we can't make them feel at home here and safe, we failed. We failed them, even if it's not our fault, even if I'm not the guy driving the pickup truck down Ruger Street with a Confederate flag in it. And I understand how that would provoke in students of color feelings of insecurity. Why am I here? And that's painful for me if I can't assure them that we will make them safe and welcome. We try, but we can't control some of the things to which they're going to be exposed here.
You mentioned a pickup truck driving through the campus because there are city, state roads that go through the campus.
Yes.
What's your assessment right now of the town-gown relations or city-gown relations?
I think it's pretty good. And I don't think it's worse than it was when I got here. I'm not sure it's any better. We've tried. I mean, I remember when Donnie Kasperzak came in to office as mayor, he and I formed a town gown sort of task force to make recommendations to how we could improve this, and they did. And we did what we could in the college to implement those recommendations. I think the town is fortunate to have the college here, although that's not always obvious to the people who live on Court Street or Brinkerhoff at 2 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
And you've been doing more linkages with Clinton Community College and businesses like the North Country Economic Development Council. How critical and how much more critical will that be in the future?
Well, it's not just that we sit in Plattsburgh. We're a major employer in the county. And our faculty and staff are out there in the schools and the churches. They have children. They're consumers. So we are as much a part of Plattsburgh as anything else. I mean, we've been here since 1889. The college acknowledges its responsibility for helping the region develop economically. I'm not an economic developer myself, and my degrees are all in history, not in business.
You mentioned being a professor of history. Do you plan to go back to teaching
at all? I would love to, Pat, if somebody will have me. I haven't stayed in touch with my field, but I've lived through much of the last, through the American century, so I ought to be able to talk about that. I'd love to teach a course somewhere, either here or back in North Dakota, wherever we end up, as long as they don't expect me to go back to graduate school and sort of renew my PhD. But if I could just teach a course, I love to teach freshmen. And when I've taught here, I've taught freshmen. Same thing when I was back in North Dakota. For several reasons. One, because I love freshmen. They're so clueless often. Why do I have to take this course? I don't care. And also because here especially, I don't want anyone to think that they're too important to teach freshmen. Everybody ought to at least acknowledge that they belong in a freshman classroom every now and then.
After you've been retired for a while and you look back on your tenure as SUNY Plattsburgh president, what do you hope your legacy is?
I'll leave others to decide what my legacy will be. I've been too close to the campus and its twists and turns over the last 15 years. So I'll let others, I'll demur on that question if you don't mind.
Okay.
I will say that there are two profound differences in our students now as compared to when I arrived 15 years ago. And I'll give you an idea of what I'm talking about. In 2004, when Lisa and I arrived in town, Mark Zuckerberg was living in a dorm at Harvard. So our kids now have grown up in a digital universe, and that's a large part of how they learn, okay? And the other is the demographic that we were talking about earlier. They're students coming from other places besides the North Country. social media. Let me just give you a quick example. From February, there was an ice storm, and everybody knew the night before that there was going to be an ice storm. I went to bed around 10 o'clock. When I got up at 5, a student had collected over 3,000 signatures on a petition online asking me to cancel classes that day. They were able to get 3,000 signatures, 3,000 plus, between 10 at night and 5 in the morning. So it's hard to stay ahead of that, you know. You can't say something, you know, snide like you're the only consumers who are happy when you get less than what you pay for. But they were demanding. And of course, they weren't all students, but it doesn't matter that they're able to do that in the middle of the night. Yeah.
It's changed.
It has changed.
Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Still to come, what makes a good school principal? We'll talk about that next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Principal Pipeline Initiative is a project funded by the Wallace Foundation that explores implementing systematic improvements to a core set of activities related to the preparation, hiring, support, and management of school leaders. The initiative was started in 2011. Recently, a study on the effectiveness of the effort was conducted by the RAND Corporation. Susan Gates is a senior economist with the RAND Corporation who specializes in education administration and policy. We talked about why the study of the Principal Pipeline Initiative was conducted.
Well, we were funded by the Wallace Foundation to conduct an evaluation of this Principal Pipeline Initiative, which is an initiative that they supported through their foundation work.
And a quick thumbnail, what is that initiative?
So the Principal Pipeline Initiative provided resources to 6 districts. They were all large school districts. And these districts were asked to implement 4 components of Principal Pipelines. They were asked to develop leader standards, which essentially define the expectations that the districts have for people who serve as principals. They were asked to improve pre-service preparation for principals. They were asked to engage in strategic hiring and placement of those principals, and then evaluate them and provide on-the-job support. So those 4 things taken together are what we call the principal pipeline. And the initiative asks the districts to approach that work strategically and comprehensively to take on all 4 of these activities and do them well.
Were those districts related in any way? They seemed kind of randomly around the country.
So the Wallace Foundation selected those districts based on their prior commitment to school leadership as a lever for improving schools. So they were selected because they had already demonstrated that they were committed to this approach, but they hadn't gotten too far down the road when this initiative started back in 2011.
Has the initiative helped find good new leaders for these schools?
Well, the districts think so. They report that by doing this work, starting with those leader standards, fleshing those out, and then letting those leader standards drive the work that they do to prepare, select, and evaluate and support those principals, that they have better principals in place. And our research demonstrates that the schools in these districts are doing better.
What makes a good principal?
Well, that's a great question. And In many ways, it depends on the context. Each of the pipeline school districts developed something that we call a leader tracking system, which gathers information about schools, the kinds of students that are served, the student achievement levels in the school, things like that, and information about the school leaders. Many times what's needed for a particular school depends on where that school's been and where it's going. So all of the districts have cross-cutting leader standards, things that they expect all of the leaders to be able to do, creating a supportive school culture, supporting teachers in their professional development. But beyond that, the job is usually different depending on what a particular school is going through.
Has it been found that developing a leader from within the district is always better than going outside, or is that another thing that has to go district by district?
That's definitely something that goes district by district. All of the districts that participated in the pipeline initiative were large, and so for them, it made sense to a certain extent to develop people from within, but even in these districts, they would sometimes hire from outside of the district. So having that flexibility, but starting from the place of being clear about what you want, being clear about what those criteria are for the people who will serve as principals in your district allows you to make that best choice between the internal candidate and someone who's applying from outside.
Is this research ongoing or are you done?
Well, we're done for now. But, the quality of school leadership is such a critical topic that we expect that we'll continue to do research in this area.
Susan Gates is a senior economist with the RAND Corporation. You can learn more about the initiative at rand.org. The flavored e-cigarette called Juul has been showing up in many places. It's especially popular across college campuses. As Quentin Len from the Syracuse University Department of Broadcast Journalism reports, the e-cigarettes aren't cheap, but that's not stopping students from using and getting hooked on them.
College students may be notoriously cheap, but when it comes to e-cigarettes, many don't seem to mind spending a good portion of their money to maintain their habit.
I Juul every single day.
Every day I probably go through about a pod a day on average.
Well, I go through a pod most likely in 2-3 days when I had my own Juul, but now it's mostly using other people's Juul.
And going through that many e-cigarettes usually leads to one key word.
If you do it every day, which is easy, it becomes addicting without even knowing it.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely addictive, yeah.
It is definitely addicting, yes, and there's no denying that. I mean, their pods are super strong, and, it's the same as a pack of cigs, so.
Medical professionals agree as well. Director of CNY's Regional Center for Tobacco Health Systems at St. Joseph's Health, Chris Owens, is among those believers.
What most people don't realize is the vast majority of those e-liquids have a substantial amount of nicotine in them.
Owens adds that the health risks are more than just the addiction.
What we're finding more and more on a regular basis is that this is kind of a gateway to more traditional tobacco products, where they start using the e-cig products because their friends are doing it, because it smells good, and that's the gateway to become nicotine dependent.
One student goes as far as to describe what withdrawing from it feels like.
Generally, what it feels like, you're just very on edge. Like, I get angry at little things a lot more, so I'm still able to get work done and function in day-to-day society, but I might snap at people or stuff like that.
Despite the addiction, many of the students feel that banning the sale of the flavored e-cigarette product would serve a good purpose.
I support it because no one can deny that Juuls and vaping have introduced an entire generation of teenagers to nicotine.
It's probably a good idea in the end, because I think in the long run they're going to find out Juuls aren't that really good for you.
Yeah, I think that's a smart thing. I think, it's a major reason why kids do it, it's just because of the fruity flavor and stuff, and then the nicotine's the after effect that kind of hooks them. So it's definitely smart to do as much as you can to stop kids from using it. And
regardless of whether legislation bans the sale of the flavored e-cigarette, Owen says more doctors are doing what they can to keep kids aware.
a provider, when they're talking with their patient, isn't just asking, do you smoke? They're saying, there's a checklist of items that pop up in the EHR where the provider can say, do you use cigarettes? Do you use a smokeless form of tobacco? Do you use an e-cig product? And so that just helps bring more awareness to the individual.
E-cigarettes have a few factors that cigarettes never had. Attractive advertising, various flavors, and a belief that they're not as bad for you as other products. While there are extensive efforts to diminish those factors, it's essential that users should be aware of the risks as well. I'm Quentin Lane.
All right, well, after tackling a few different topics today, let's close out the program with a nice walk in the woods. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Taking a walk in the woods can be good for brain health. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Susan Massino, professor of applied science at Trinity College, explores why forests are important to our health.
Forests are essential to life and emerged 380 million years ago. They've recovered from catastrophic volcanic eruptions, ice ages, and meteor strikes. European settlers deforested much of New England, and today we appreciate forests for many values, including human health. Forests offer exercise, solace, medicines, and biodiversity. New species are still being discovered in New England. As a neuroscientist, I know the link between forests and brain health cannot be overlooked. We face increasing costs for disorders ranging from Alzheimer's disease to addiction. Lifestyle modifications are effective and successful, and forests offer exercise, mindfulness, and stress reduction naturally. United States veterans suffering from PTSD can reduce medication use, and research on cardiovascular, immune, and neurological systems is expanding worldwide. A forest can also increase kindness, altruism, and generosity by provoking awe, the sense of wonder you feel in the presence of something beyond your understanding. We have very little original forest in New England, but we can plan now to have old local forests in the future. Even a small forest is important. At 40 acres, Belden Forest in downtown Simsbury, Connecticut, is the latest addition to the Old Growth Forest Network. Our well-being depends on wild areas, connecting between human generations, and increasing in biodiversity and resilience over time like they have for millions of years. Letting our forests grow is also the most rapid, efficient, and cost-effective thing we can do to sequester carbon and combat climate change. Today, New England forests are still young and growing and have the potential to store a lot more carbon while controlling floods and buffering temperature fluctuations. Knowing that forests can treat disease, give us new medicines, and help us survive climate change means that we really can see beyond the trees.
That was Susan Massino of Trinity College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Mm-hmm.